You're listening to
the DEA Podcast.
The opinions expressed on the DEA Podcast are merely the streaming thoughts of the host and guests and should not be relied upon or acted upon without further due diligence. If you do not agree to this, then you must immediately switch off and run far, far away. Permission to republish the DEA Podcast is permitted, providing a link to the show notes is included.
Podcast@energy-performance-certificate.org.
And good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the DEA Podcast, episode 17. I'm Mike C, and today is the 23rd of October, 2007. Getting straight to it today, it is my unbridled pleasure to welcome Brian Scannell, the Managing Director of Sava, the company behind, well, it is the EPC. They are, without them, I dare say this, we wouldn't have even got this far. I feel as though there's only one more person left to interview after this, and that is God himself. But for now, we'll just have to do with Brian. Brian, are you there?
I am. Thanks. I'm not sure I'm going to live up to the billing, but thank you anyway.
Brian, pleasure to have you. Thank you for your time, for coming on and speaking to everybody. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background and history?
Sure, and thank you for the invitation to speak to you today. Oh Lord, my background, well, it's sort of, I've been working with National Energy Services, the parent company of Sava, since 1997, and National Energy Services has been involved in energy ratings, training people, providing them with software, and running quality assurance for the energy ratings since probably mid-80s in terms of when it really first started. And it really is the case that the company was there right at the beginnings of energy ratings, and I'm pretty proud to be able to be taking forward that company, in that legacy. I mean, prior to that, I was working out in Hong Kong and prior to that in Wales, so truly exotic locations, with an environmental consultancy background. My degree was in oceanography and electronics, and it was offshore surveying and water quality work and computer modeling that I then got involved with. So,
Wow.
A fairly divergent background, but since 97, it's been very much focused around energy efficiency and what we can do to reduce cost, reduce waste, and reduce environmental impact.
Yeah, that is a varied and deep background. I couldn't possibly comment on any of those. I can't, forgive me if I can't ask you to expand on any, because I fear that you'd just go straight over my head, so we best move on.
don't worry about it. It kept me occupied, kept me off the streets for the last 20-odd years, whenever long it is.
Oceanography, that's, I've never met anybody involved in that, really. So, sounds interesting.
Mostly getting seasick and working on a computer, from my point of view, but it has had its moments.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but you bought out Sava, didn't you?
Yeah. Sava was acquired by National Energy Services in late in 2003, and it's a wholly owned subsidiary of National Energy Services. In practice, we don't tend to trade through that company now, but Sava remains a very important brand within the company. So National Energy Services is the legal entity, and we trade through two brands, National Home Energy Rating, NHER, for most of our straight energy issues, and Sava for the more home condition report and property-related side of things. Of course, it's got a little bit confused since the home condition report became voluntary and the EPC became mandatory, but those are our two brands, and we're proud of the association for both of them.
And can you just explain to everyone where NHER plays in this?
Yeah, the National Home Energy Rating Scheme, the NHER, was really the original energy rating scheme. And NES took over the running of that scheme from our parent charity, the National Energy Foundation, when NES was established. And the scheme predates the introduction of the SAP rating. And there was the NHER rating, and there still is an NHER rating scale, that now runs as a complement to the SAP, but originally it preceded the SAP and was a complete forerunner of it. There are some differences between the NHER rating as a rating and the SAP rating. The NHER includes a wider range of energy uses within the homes. So it includes full lighting and appliances, whereas the SAP only includes a proportion of lighting. And the NHER is much more sensitive to the location of a dwelling. But other than that, the principles are very much the same. It's a way of ranking the energy efficiency of a property based on the running costs for energy required to heat, light, and, in the NHER case, power the home.
Are you trying to tell us in a roundabout way, Brian, that the NHER scale is a better than the RDSAP?
Well, we have for a long time held that the NHER was a better rating than the SAP rating, but it is a proprietary product, and governments don't necessarily like proprietary products. And so the SAP came in, and we don't really agree with some of the compromises that were made to create the SAP. We don't think it's appropriate to ignore the fact that actually it's much colder in northern England than it is in southwest England, and therefore that affects energy consumption. When it comes to regulation, sometimes you are limited in the influence that that you can have on the regulators.
You've been involved in this, I think, since the beginning, haven't you, really? And I think a few people have said to me within the industry, really, that without just the presence of SAVA, controversial or not, it doesn't matter, but just the mere presence of a body like yourselves, this probably wouldn't be able to play out. Would you say that's right?
My ego is big enough.
Well, yeah, but push that aside a sec.
I mean, in practice, there have, over the years, been relatively few voices who were unequivocally supportive of energy performance certificates and the role of training and quality assurance within that. And I suppose we have been one of the more consistent voices in calling on the government and in lobbying to get action. I mean, it really does go back to way before the Energy Performance in Buildings Directive was actually passed, that we were trying to sort of make this happen. I mean, trying to get energy ratings onto homes when they're bought, sold, rented out has been a goal of National Energy Services and our parent charity, the Foundation, since it was first established. So, you know, we have completely unapologetically been very, very keen advocates of the Energy Performance Certificate. And for us, the Home Information Pack is a means to an end, to be perfectly honest. You know, I can completely support the logic that the Home Information Pack should be able to improve buying and selling, and as someone who's bought and sold properties, anything that can improve the efficiency of that process has got to be a good thing. I was personally very, very keen on the Home Condition Report. I think it's a fantastic product. Yes, there's always scope for making it better, but the idea of providing every prospective purchaser with information on the condition of a property just seems to me to be so self-evidently a good thing that I find the current situation intensely frustrating. But, you know, that's a battle that we haven't yet walked away from, and we have no intentions of walking away from. We're going to keep plugging away to try and get the HCR reinstated and recognised for the valuable source of information that it is. But right now, we are pleased to see the EPC finally coming out there, but we're just desperately frustrated at the appalling lack of progress that's being made.
You are a non-profit organisation, is that right?
No, our parent charity, the National Energy Foundation, is that. It is a charity, it's a not-for-profit organisation. National Energy Services is a straight commercial company. It just happens that the majority of our shares are owned by a charity. But we are subject to the same commercial rigours and expectations of any other company. And, you know, a charity is the same as any other shareholder. They expect a level of performance. The only thing that is slightly different is that in terms of our strategy, the charity is much more tolerant of us pursuing a strategic direction that is beneficial for the charity's goal in the longer term. So we, you know, we are subject to commercial expectations from our shareholders, but we can sometimes persuade the shareholders to take a longer term view on things because what we're doing is aligned with the goals of the charity.
And thank the Lord for that patience, hasn't it? I mean, you've been in this now, you've been very patient in this. It must have cost you significant amounts of money. I mean, there must be a hell of a strain on the company at the moment.
Well, I mean, you know, the company's financial records are a matter of public record. I mean, we have run at a loss for several years. And, you know, we are not expecting to be making huge amounts of profit this year. I am hoping that we will make a small profit this financial year, which our financial year finishes at the end of November. But if people think that we're raking in huge amounts of money and living the life of Riley off the back of it, then if only we're be my reaction to that. No, it's, you know, we are still investing faster than we are receiving income.
It must be very frustrating. Do you think you are at a disadvantage to new players coming into the market at the moment?
Oh, undoubtedly. If you look at what happened with, for example, things like the market for training or indeed the accreditation schemes, you know, all of the hard work in terms of working with government on what's required for the qualification, what's required in terms of the accreditation schemes and the QA regimes that they to operate under, all of that has come off the back of a huge amount of hard work. And I wouldn't say it's just on our part, but we were certainly one of the organisations that was working very hard to make that happen. Now, you know, that incurs costs, and then new entrants come along, and once all the hard work's been done, and basically get to free ride off the back of it. I mean, you know, the range of training organisations that are out there now is quite extraordinary, and, you know, organisations popping out of the woodwork to become accreditation schemes with a negligible.
Okay, Brian, I don't know whether you can hear me, but you went very, very quiet and muffled then in the background.
Hello? Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's better.
The key point that I would make about new entrants is that, you know, yes, they are effectively freeloading off the back of the work that others have done before them. But, you know, that is a good thing from the point of view of customers and of DEAs, that they are faced with choices. They have more choice. They can choose the supplier that they want to work with, whether it be a training organization or an accreditation scheme. And our future success is going to be dependent upon our ability to continue to meet the needs and expectations and the quality of service that our customers want from us. So, you know, in a sense, the history helps, but in terms of giving us knowledge and an understanding of where we are, but it doesn't count for anything in terms of ensuring that we give people the service and support that they need.
It gives you the authority, really, doesn't it, and the respect, which I think is apparent amongst most people's minds, anyway.
I hope so, but we have to keep, you know, that is something that you have to keep working on. We can't just rest on our laurels. We have to constantly make sure that we are improving the service that we provide, whether it be through the technical bulletins or the telephone support lines or just our administration processes or anything else. But, you know, we have to get the mixture of the charges we impose on people and the support and services we provide to them right. And if we don't get it right, then like any other commercial organisation, our customers will vote with their feet. And that is a constant challenge that we have to keep working on to make sure that we get the balance right.
Okay, let's move on to the news, which there hasn't been really much of since our last podcast, but something did crop up, and in fact, it was Saba. there was an article that came out claiming that there was a conflict of interest between BRE and Saba and other participants in the same game. I'm not sure whether this actually applies to the realm of energy performance certificates, but perhaps you would just like to paint a background and clarify that for us.
Yeah, what we were concerned about was the way that CLG worked with BRE, and you know, I want to emphasise here that I'm not having a go at BRE. They are a commercial organisation who will inevitably and quite rightly take advantage of any opportunities that are open to them. It's actually the way that CLG work with them that is causing us some concern. The main issue, or the most immediate issue, is to do with something called the Code for Sustainable Homes and the overlap between that and EPCs for new homes, which is probably of only marginal interest to most the existing DEAs. But at the moment, the government is out to consultation on the implementation of mandatory code assessments for all new homes, which would go alongside the EPC. But the code itself is based on an assessment methodology called EcoHomes, which was developed by BRE actually before BRE were ever privatised. It was whilst BRE was still in a publicly owned company, or effectively part of the government itself. But the intellectual property in the code remained with BRE when they were privatised, and the government are currently proposing that BRE would be able to remain as the monopoly accreditor for individuals wishing to produce code assessments, but they are saying that BRE would be able to sublicense other organisations, and we just don't think that it is appropriate that that sort of monopoly situation should arise, particularly if BRE become eligible to run an accreditation scheme for new build DEAs. There are then other problems, like at the moment, any organisation wishing to, well, any accreditation scheme producing software, whether it be for new build homes or for existing homes, currently has to submit that software to BRE for approval on behalf of, on the part of the government. Well, if they are a competing organisation, it is completely inappropriate that they have a position to say yes or no to our software, or to say yes or no as to whether or not we are allowed to become a code accreditation scheme. So it's a fairly involved problem, but it's to do with the way that CLG treat BRE as though they were an extension of the civil service when it suits them, but they also treat them as a commercial organization, and BRE quite rightly behave as a commercial organization when the opportunity presents itself. So it's a frustrating situation from our point of view, but basically we have, along with Elmhurst, have written to the National Audit Office and asked them to investigate it, investigate the situation, and hopefully to encourage CLG to more clearly distinguish between the roles of regulator and regulated. I mean, in essence, you shouldn't be both a regulator and a competitor in the marketplace, is the argument that we're presenting.
So in, I suppose really that they're imposing their will on the market via the vehicle of BRE. What if it doesn't go your way then?
To be honest, I don't think it's a terribly conscious decision. Right. I think it is just a reflection of the fact that CLG are not a terribly commercially minded institution. You know, I just don't think they understand how commercial markets work, and therefore how they should interact with organizations that are operating within those commercial markets. You know, there's a desire that there is an open and competitive marketplace for accreditation schemes and for DEAs and for home inspectors. But if that is what they want to achieve, their behavior has to reflect and support that goal, and it doesn't always.
How frustrating has it been over the 10 years you've been involved in this to be actually dealing with a carousel of ministers?
Yes, it's not just the ministers, unfortunately. It's the individual civil servants sort of come and go, and there's a collective knowledge which could be measured in weeks and months, rather than the years that it has taken us to get to this position. And there is a certain element of constantly having to remind people about how did we end up here? You know, why were decisions made the way they were at different times? And it is frustrating, but you just can't dwell on it, otherwise you end up going mad. I used to just have a lot more hair than I've got now, sort of. But it is frustrating, and it does lead one to question the way governments and civil servants operate and their actual ability to deliver on complex arrangements. You know, it is now completely understandable to me just how every government IT project under the sun pretty much goes completely pear-shaped, because actually there's so little continuity in terms of this is the vision of what we are trying to achieve and these are the steps we are going to take to actually deliver on that vision. It is almost inevitable that that problems arise, because new people come in, they forget one set of decisions has been made. They don't really have a clear view as to what they are trying to deliver or why they are trying to deliver it. And there is so much stakeholder engagement that it is that there's no clarity of purpose. That inevitably results in problems.
I can only imagine. Perhaps we need to be a dictatorship.
the benign dictatorship. I promise to be good, honest. You know, I think it's like everybody says. You know, democracy is a completely useless system of government. It's just it happens to be better than anything else anyone's come up with.
Well, anyway, let's not go too too far astray because I could. But anyway, thanks for clarifying that over the conflict of interest anyway. I suppose we should explore further the consequences of last week's Expo keynote speech given by Ian Wright, which still it's still being talked about today. And that is obviously that the delay of HIPs is now being held back by the housing market. So something that's been preying on my mind since then is it not time now to be actually campaigning for the release of EPC from the constraints of the Home Information Pack?
Well, I mean, that raises the question as to whether or not the government would then introduce EPCs, even if they were free of HIPs. I don't think the issue is that. I don't believe that there is any loss of faith in the Home Information Pack itself. I think the problem is that there is a completely paranoid fear that if there is going to be a downturn in the housing market, nobody wants to have done anything or even to be standing in the vicinity of making a decision, that the media could turn around and make an accusation that that was what caused the problem. I don't believe anybody genuinely believes that if HIPs were introduced to the whole market tomorrow, that they would create a house price crash. But I don't think they want to run any risk of that accusation, no matter how false, actually being laid at their doors. And what that means is you effectively just sit on your hands and don't make a decision about anything until you are confident that there isn't going to be a downward turn in the house prices, or until it's happened, and then you can't be accused of having caused the problem.
But go ahead.
So all I was going to say was that even if they did separate the EPC from the HIP, which I don't think would be a good idea, but even if they did, I still don't think they would take the decision to introduce them.
Well, aren't HIPs supposed to make the home buying and selling process easier, to reduce failed transactions, to speeden up and make more efficient the conveyancing process, to allay the buyer before they get involved in dirty negotiations, that everything, you know, appears okay? If anything, this should be beneficial to the housing market. By not introducing them, aren't they admitting that we're not quite confident about the claims of HIPs?
But you're applying logic to a situation where I'm not sure that the decision process is a logical decision process. I just do not believe, I just don't have any confidence that the decision as to whether to proceed or not is subject to that sort of logical scrutiny. I think it is much more the case of, if I make the decision to say go and then something bad happens, someone's going to accuse me of having caused that bad thing, and I don't want to be in the media with anybody having made that accusation, no matter how untrue it would be or how completely disingenuous it would be. That I just don't think they want to take that risk.
And go ahead.
It just means that we're kind of caught in a limbo land. I mean, one of the things that we did know was going to happen was that there would be a short-term effect due to sort of pre-listing and then a certain amount of avoidance post the implementation. So there was going to be an impact on a short-term impact on the listings market. But there was also a recognition that there would probably be a long-term impact on the listings market as people who were dipping their toe in the market or just, you know, testing the market out became less likely to do that in a post-HIP environment. Now, actually, that's a good thing because people who are just testing the market are not committed sellers, and therefore they are more associated with failed transactions. But it does mean that there was an expectation of some level of systemic reduction in the number of listings that would take place. Now, you know, at one point, and I can remember going way back, estate agents who were fundamentally opposed to HIPs were arguing that that reduction in the number of people listing would lead to huge house price increases and we would get massive price inflation. You know, now they're using exactly the same concerns to argue that they're bringing about a price collapse, and it doesn't necessarily make any sense. But I think from a politician's point of view, the one thing you don't want to be is in a position where somebody can accuse you of something, no matter how true or untrue it might be. I think it's cowardice that's driving the decision making at the moment rather than anything else.
Yeah, I think it's you're right. They're just trying to dodge a bullet. But I mean, how long will it be now until the housing market is officially declared safe? It could be years in theory. I mean, the indicators are mixed at the moment, but tend to be on the side of the wrong side at least. And how long is it before the Greenpeace people come out and say, look, how serious are you about climate change? Why are you holding back the EPC?
Well, absolutely. And this is really why we have kick-started the petition, because I no longer have confidence that we can say, oh, well, it's only a matter of weeks or months away before they make this decision. I think we are into a completely unknown territory now, where, as far as I can see it, the criteria by which they make the judgment as to whether they go forward or not change according to what their biggest fear is. You know, whilst their biggest fear was that there weren't enough qualified DEAs or HIs, then that was the criteria that they use for not going forward. Now they're saying, well, it's to do with the volatility of the market. You know, what comes next? And unfortunately, I think the green commitment is shallow enough that it gets pushed aside when other political concerns arise. So I think it is time to take a more direct action, and both in from the HIDEA community, but also from the green community. And you know, we are in touch with the green groups, trying to get them to help put increased pressure on the government, because we're already years behind in terms of the implementation of the Energy Performance in Buildings Directive. You know, it should have been in place back 4th of January 2006. You know, the only justification they've had since that date for not having implemented its requirements are a shortage of of qualified individuals. You know, that is the only get out of jail clause in the directive. Well, we know that excuse is now completely and utterly specious. You know, there is absolutely no justification for not having implemented EPCs, not just on marketed sales, but I think on construction and indeed on rental. And we've got to try and get every body who is interested in getting EPCs into the marketplace, whether it's through the whether it's because they're interested in making sure the HIP market takes off, or whether it's just because they're interested in making sure that EPCs are in place, we've got to get everybody working towards that goal and putting as much pressure on the government as they can.
Do you have a survey that you wish people to, or petition / survey, I don't know, a petition, let's call it, that you've created and want people to get behind, which I'll include in the show notes. What that is calling on for the full implementation now, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we want to see two things specifically: the implementation of a commencement order for the final phase of the rollout of home information packs, so that we've got implementation by the end of November. But we're also calling on the introduction of EPCs for rental dwellings, and to bring forward the necessary orders to make sure that that implementation takes place from the 1st of January 2008. You know, we believe that the resources in terms of the numbers of qualified people are there to support that, and therefore the directive should come into force. You know, we have to do everything we can to put as much pressure as possible onto the government to bring these things forward. It's going to be a hugely uphill task. They do not want to do either of those things.
Exactly. You're in between a rock and a hard place in many ways, because if you push the government into implementing it and then a scenario does occur in which they're blamed, well, the Home Information Pact is blamed, then that reflects on the people that pushed for it to go ahead, doesn't it? It'd be the vested interest argument coming out again. Which again, you know, I can't help but be drawn towards thinking that perhaps it is time for the EPC to be free. I know that we've already talked about it, Brian, so it just seems the less risky way forward, because I can't see home information packs, if they're being tied to the housing market, being released to the full market anytime soon, really. And there's 10,000 people.
I think it is important, though, to remember that home information packs are already delivering benefits. You know, if you look at what's happening in the search market and the improvement in standards within the search market and the reduction of costs within the search market, it's already evident that home information packs are having a beneficial effect. Now, okay, you know, there's still a long way to go in terms of delivering the full benefits. And I think that can only be delivered once the home condition report is back in the home information pack. But I do not believe that we would not be that simply separating the EPC would lead to an earlier introduction of the EPC. I think we would be faced with exactly the same problems.
I agree. Yeah. It would need a total radical rethink of implementation on that particular item. I know, but anyway, we've spoken enough about that. Let's move on.
You're listening to the DEA podcast.
Rise of the ratings. Who came up with that title? Because I want to put a delay and echo on that and just go rise of the ratings with guest speaker thermonuclear reactive man.
It was one of. But yes, I mean, and you know, the conference has been in planning now for many months, and I have to be honest, you know, did we anticipate that we'd be in this situation at the time we set up, we set the dates for the conference and committed to going ahead with it? No, we thought we would be in a full HIP rollout market, and that there would be a lot of very, very busy home inspectors and DEAs out there. So we are in a much more difficult market than we had anticipated when we committed to running the conference. But it doesn't change the fact that there is a huge amount still to be done under the Energy Performance in Buildings Directive, and the changes that are coming down the line in terms of EPCs for commercial buildings, EPCs in the dwellings rental sector. There is a lot to be discussed, and there's a lot of useful information that we hope that the conference will bring out and bring to the delegates who are attending.
When did you actually plan this conference then? Because you can't turn them around in a month, can you?
Oh no! This is what between six and 8 months ago we had started the planning on the conference. I mean, it's ages ago. I mean, we've been committed to the dates and venue for months. You know, you just can't get hold of venues and that sort of short notice. So, you know, when we get accusations of, you know, insensitivity in terms of running the conference and you know, just I do understand it, but I think it I think people need to understand just how long the timescales are that planning for these sorts of events has to take place over, and just how expensive they are to run. You know, they are ferociously expensive events to actually set up and manage.
Well, I will hold my hands up and say that I did say something on one of the podcasts few weeks ago now about the insensitivity of the time and the expense. But having, you know, just reflected on what you say, at that time of planning, then you had fully, you had no reason to suspect that there wouldn't be a full market implementation and that people would be earning a living to be able to afford this. So that's a fair comment.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have tried to keep the cost down as low as possible. I know it's still an expensive event to attend in terms of sort of, you know, by the time you add in traveling to London and some accommodation and those sort of things, I do appreciate it, and I'm really grateful for those that are giving up their time and their money to actually attend. We're going to do absolutely everything we can to make sure that they get value for money, but I do sympathise with those that that aren't able to attend, and I really do understand that it must be rather galling to see us promoting an event like this.
Well, the train's in motion now, isn't it? You've got to, it can't be stopped easily.
Well, the train's been in motion for a long time, and it is a case of it would have been absolutely hugely expensive for us to have derailed it any time in the last 3 months.
Would you consider next year holding it outside of London somewhere?
Well, I mean, the NHER and SAVA conferences over the years have nearly all been held outside London. It's one of those issues that everybody has a really strong opinion about where conferences should be held, and strangely, most people think that it should be held close to them.
Yeah.
And there just isn't a good location. The one huge advantage of London is that everybody has a pretty straightforward route to get there, whereas when you choose other locations, it nearly always disadvantages some people. And if you look at the centre of mass of population and the population of DEAs and things, it does push you towards the southeast of the country. We review kind of where we run the conferences. I mean, in the past, we've run the SAVA conferences have nearly all been run in Warwick up until now. The NHER conference has been in Birmingham, and Stratford-on-Avon was another one that I remember. They have moved around a bit, but when you start looking for venues that have got the size that we need and a location that's got good transport links from throughout the country, it's very difficult to avoid coming to the conclusion that London is a better venue than many.
Well, I know the local landlord to the old Red Lion here. I'm sure he'd be up for it next year.
Well, I mean, this year we've got check the latest data, but you know, we're going to have somewhere around 250 delegates at this year's conference, and then by the time you add in all of the staff that are needed to support that event and the speakers and all the rest of it, you're talking about 300 people in all probability. There aren't that many venues that can give you space for that number of people and have a choice of accommodation to meet those individuals' needs sort of in reasonable proximity. So, you know, the sheer size of the event starts to limit the choices that we have available to us.
Sure. Are the places still available for that, Brian?
There certainly are. If anyone's interested in attending, they'd be very welcome. And just give us a call in the office. And the telephone number is 01908 442 111. And or they can go via the website. We'd be very pleased to see them there.
Is there a discount for podcast listeners?
there is a discount for members of the SAVA and NHER schemes, yes. Many of whom I am sure are podcast listeners.
Indeed. Okay, well, I put a question out for anybody that wants to put the question to you, so to speak. So let's run through a few of those.
You're listening to the DEA podcast.
Tune in to part two.